Our text is from Jude, verse 3. For these lectures, a vindication of the Baptists. Beloved, when I gave all diligence to write unto you of the common salvation, it was needful for me to write unto you and to exhort you that ye should earnestly contend for the faith which was once delivered unto the saints. Between the word "the" and the word "faith," we have these words, which was once delivered unto the saints. We are bound by the Word of God and by the needs of the hour to contend for the primitive faith. The faith of the New Testament, and part of that faith is the truth concerning the church and concerning our entire corporate relationship. These lectures on a vindication of the Baptist we have divided into four parts. First, why is such a vindication necessary? Second, a statement on Baptist distinctives. Third, a description of the nature and character of the New Testament church. And finally, a discussion of Baptist antiquities. These things, these truths and realities, deriving from the Word of God and witnessed by history, are extremely necessary in this secularized age in which we live. An age that does not take into consideration its historical or biblical roots. And we live in a time when the whole concept and reality of the New Testament church is all but gone. We are involved now, and God willing, will conclude today this series of studies. We are dealing with Baptist antiquities. Again, we do not contend for the antiquity of the name Baptist, nor do we promulgate the theory that there is a chain-link succession of Baptist churches from the New Testament to the present time. We hold, however, that New Testament churches, New Testament individuals, have always existed, even in those dark days before the Protestant Reformation, in what we call the Dark Ages and medieval times. We have approach this study by dealing with various major groups of people that have left their footprints in history, separate from and persecuted by the Church of Rome. The Montanists, predominant from the 2nd through the 8th centuries. The Novatians, prominent from the 3rd to the 8th centuries. Primitive British Christianity to the 6th century. The Donatists, predominant from the 4th through the 7th centuries. The Paulicians, from the 7th through the 16th centuries. The Bogomili, from the 9th through the 16th centuries. The Albigenses, from the 10th through the 16th centuries. The Paterines of Italy, from the 9th through the 13th centuries. Medieval British Christianity, from the 6th through the 14th centuries. The Lollards and the Wycliffeites, the 14th and 15th centuries. The Bohemian Brethren, the 15th century. And now we have reserved until the last that group of people which both Romish and Protestant historians have had been forced to laud as the inheritors of primitive Christianity extending from the 3rd down to the 16th century, the Waldenses. Now, the Waldenses form the largest and most prominent group during the Dark Ages, the Medieval Ages, the Renaissance area, into the time of the Reformation. It is erroneous to think that they took their name from Peter Waldo of the 12th century. Indeed, it is quite possible that he, as others, took his name from this movement. The word Waldense or Valdense means the people of the valleys, and it extends back to the Constantinian change of 313 A.D. These Waldenses perpetuated New Testament Christianity in the valleys of the Piedmont in Italy from the time of the Emperor Constantine until the Protestant Reformation. Some of these amalgamated with Calvin and became the Huguenots of France. The ancient Waldenses retained their separation, and although at times banished and had repeated crusades sent against them, maintained the ancient or primitive faith, and their influence spread from Eastern Europe, the Near East, to the British Isles. The origin and antiquity of the Waldenses dates, as I said, from the time of Constantine and Pope Sylvester, the early part of the 4th century, about 330 A.D. The valleys of the Piedmont had always proven a haven for those who were dissidents from Romanism. These merged with the indigenous churches that had existed there for generations. It is known that in the time of Montanus, in the early 2nd century, and Novatian in the 3rd century, many found refuge in these valleys. I'm going to quote from an Anglican, George Stanley Faber. "The evidence which I have now adduced distinctly proves not only that the Waldenses and Albigenses existed anterior to Peter of Lyons, but the Valencic churches were so ancient that the remote commencement was placed by their inquisitive enemies themselves far beyond the memory of man." Now, Theodore Beza, who was Calvin's successor at Geneva and one who had intimate knowledge of the Waldensian brethren, he declares, "As for the Waldenses, I may be permitted to call them the very seed of the primitive and purer church, since they are those that have been upheld, as is abundantly manifest, by the wonderful providence of God, so that neither those endless storms and tempests by which the whole Christian world has been shaken for so many succeeding ages, nor those horrible persecutions which have been expressly raised against them, were ever able so far as to prevail to make them bend or yield a voluntary subjection to the Roman tyranny and idolatry." Oliver Cromwell, the Lord Protector of England, in the early 1700s, was greatly concerned about these people who still were largely in the valleys of the Piedmont. He held these people with the highest regard and regarded them as the holders of primitive Christianity. He challenged the heads of Europe, "If you do not cease your persecution of the Waldenses, I will mount an army and invade Europe for their protection." He commissioned Sir Samuel Morland to personally see about their welfare and stated that these were the most ancient stock of pure religion. Morland's book upon his investigation and sojourn among the Waldenses is still in print today by some small Baptist printers, The Evangelical Churches of the Valleys of the Piedmont, written in the middle of the 17th century. I now quote Dr. Alex Munston, another Protestant historian. The Vaudois of the Alps are, in our view, primitive Christians or inheritors of the primitive church who have been preserved in these valleys from the alternatives successively introduced by the Church of Rome. It is not they who separated from Catholicism, but Catholicism which separated from them in modifying the primitive worship. In the Reformation era, it was a common inquiry on the part of these people to their Protestant antagonists. Where was your church before Luther or Calvin? They believed themselves to be the successors of apostolic Christianity. I'm now going to quote the Protestant historian Neander, who was a Lutheran. It is not without some foundation of truth that the Waldenses of this period asserted the high antiquity of their sect and maintained that from the time of the secularization of the church, that is, from the time of the Constantinian change and Pope Sylvester, such an opposition finally broke forth for them, had been existing all along. They antedated themselves to the Constantinian change of the state church. Now I'm going to give a very lengthy quote from Wilhelmus Abrakel, Dutch Reformed theologian who wrote in 1699. The end of the 17th century, he was Dutch Reformed. He was not a Baptist. He was not an Anabaptist. His works in four volumes, The Christian's Reasonable Service, have just been translated into English in the last few years. He writes, where was the Reformed Church prior to Zwingli, Luther, and Calvin? By the word Reformed, and I take an aside here, he means the Calvinistic Church or the true evangelical church. The word Reformed was used then and is used now of true gospel doctrine. He writes, where was the Reformed Church prior to Zwingli, Luther, and Calvin? Answer, first of all, the true church remains steadfast by reason of her durability, a durability which does not fluctuate. True doctrine is an infallible distinguishing mark of the church. Wherever true doctrine resides, there also is the church. Prior to Luther, this church existed. Wherever this true doctrine, which never ceased to be, was to be found. The church existed in several independent churches, which maintained separation from popery. Such churches existed since early times in the southern parts of France, as well in some parts of England, Scotland, Bohemia, and also in the Piedmont. Against these churches, popes have initiated many persecutions, but they have continued to exist until this day. Prior to the time of Zwingli and Luther, there had been very many who adhered to the same doctrine. Renarius, one of the leaders of the Inquisition of Rome, who did some writing prior to the year 1400, describes concerning the Waldenses. So, Wilhelmus Abrakel is now quoting Renarius, one of the leading inquisitors from the Church of Rome who persecuted these people. Among all sects that either are or have been, there is none more detrimental to the Roman Catholic Church than that of the Leonists, that is, the poor men of Lyons, the Waldenses. It is the sect that is of the longest standing of any, for some say it has existed since the time of the apostles. It is the most general of all sects, for scarcely is there any country to be found where this sect has not been embraced. This sect has a great appearance of godliness, since they live righteously before all men, believe all that God has said, and maintain all the articles contained in the Symbolum. That is their 12 articles of faith. Archbishop Cellius, Roman Catholic, writes in his book against the Waldenses. The Waldenses originate from a religious man named Leo, who lived during the time of the first Christian emperor, Constantine the Great, 313 A.D. Abreckel concludes, "Such is the witness of these parties. Do you yet ask where the Reformed Church existed prior to Luther? To this I reply, she was to be found among those whom we have just mentioned, that is, those residing in the Piedmont among the Waldenses." Jonathan Edwards, our own great American theologian, evangelist, and philosopher, in his book, The History of Redemption, stated the following: "In every age of this dark time, there appeared particular persons in all parts of Christendom who bore a testimony against the corruptions and tyranny of the Church of Rome. God was pleased to maintain an uninterrupted succession of many witnesses through the whole time. Besides these, there was a certain people called the Waldenses, who lived separately from the rest of the world and constantly bore a witness against the Church of Rome through all this dark time. They served God in the ancient purity of His worship and never submitted to the Church of Rome." Now I'm going to quote E.H. Broadbent, a Brethren historian. In all of these works, we have quoted Roman Catholics and Protestants and their witness and testimony to our Baptistic forefathers. "In the Alpine valleys," I'm quoting Broadbent now, "of Piedmont, there have been for centuries congregations of believers calling themselves Brethren, who came later to be widely known as Waldenses or Vaudois." And this, of course, means people of the valleys. "They trace their origin in those parts back to apostolic times. Like many of the so-called Cathar, Paulatian, and other churches, these were not reformed, never having degenerated from the New Testament pattern, as had the Roman, Greek, and some others, but having always maintained, in varying degree, the apostolic tradition. From the time of Constantine, there had continued to be a succession of those who preached the gospel and founded churches, uninfluenced by the relations between church and state existing at that time. This accounts for the large bodies of Christians, well established in the Scriptures and free from idolatry and other evils prevailing in the dominant professing church, to be found in the Alpine valleys." Just some quotations concerning that greatest of all groups of people that existed from the time of Constantine to the Reformation, the Waldenses, or people of the valleys. We move now to the Anabaptists of the Reformation era, and we are presented with a dilemma for Protestant historians. At the dawn of the Protestant Reformation, thousands of individuals came out of the Black Forest of Germany and the surrounding country to welcome Luther and the Reformers. They had churches, they were developed in their doctrine, and they were called Anabaptists because they immersed all who came to them. The issue is, where did these people come from? Where was their origin? They were not primitive. They didn't simply just develop. They weren't holding to the doctrine of the Reformers. They were well established and they came out in the various countries of Europe by the hundreds of thousands from Britain to Eastern Europe and beyond to welcome the Reformation, and they were met with blood and fire and slaughter. For the Reformers did not establish New Testament churches. They simply established rival state churches to that of Rome. And early on, the name Anabaptist became synonymous with anarchists. Those of you who have had opportunity to study Baptist confessions of faith can understand that in the 1644 First London Baptist Confession of Faith, signed by seven congregations of Christ in London, in their heading they said, falsely called Anabaptists, because Anabaptists was synonymous with anarchy. These people came out because they had existed for years, we believe for centuries, by various names before the Reformation began. The term Anabaptist is associated with anarchism, and some would trace Baptist beginnings to the madmen of Munster. During the Munster Rebellion, there was a group known as Anabaptists in the area of Munster, and they were finally exterminated. They resprinkled those who came to them. They were not truly Anabaptists, that is, immersers, nor was their doctrine New Testament. I recall a good friend, and he is still a good friend, a Presbyterian friend of mine, and in a conversation in the presence of several other Presbyterian ministers, he said to me, "Ah, Bill," he said, "you Baptist, you trace yourself all the way back to John the Baptist." And I said to my friend, "John the who?" End of conversation. What was the origin of these people? In previous centuries, they had been known as Hussites, Wycliffeites, Bohemian Brethren, Albigenses, Waldenses, and others. They came and revealed themselves in the Reformation as fully organized, fully developed, and there were multitudes of them. I'm going to quote now from John Lawrence von Mosheim, a Lutheran who is known as the father of modern church history. He wrote in the late 1700s and early 1800s. He was an avowed enemy of the Baptists. "The origin of the Anabaptist is lost in the remote depths of antiquity. Before the rise of Luther or Calvin, there lay concealed in almost all the countries of Europe persons who adhered tenaciously to the principles of the modern Dutch Baptists." From one of our avowed enemies, Robert Barclay, a Quaker historian, "The rise of the Anabaptists took place prior to the Reformation of the Church of England. And there were also reasons for believing that the continent of Europe, small hidden societies who have held many of the opinions of the Anabaptists, have existed from the time of the apostles." Zwingli, the Swiss reformer in Zurich, who for a time marched with the Anabaptists, later turned against them for the principle of a state church and killed and persecuted and drowned many of his former companions in the lake at Zurich. He said, "They want water, let them have it." And they chained them together and drowned them in the lake. He declared this: "The institution of the Anabaptist is no novelty, but for 1,300 years has caused great trouble to the church." And he wrote this in the early 1500s. Dr. Ludwig Keller, a Lutheran historian, the Royal Munster archivist, who had great and intimate knowledge of the Anabaptists of the Reformation era, possessing all the documents, wrote this: "There were Baptists long before the Munster Rebellion. A contemporary who was not a Baptist has this testimony concerning the beginning of the movement. The Anabaptist movement was so rapid that the presence of Baptist views was speedily discovered in all parts of the land. The more I examine the documents of that time at my command, the more I am astonished at the extent of the diffusion of Anabaptist views, an extent of which no other investigator has any knowledge. Many Baptist churches cannot be enumerated for reason that their existence was a profound secret. It is not to be doubted also that in the progress of scientific invention, still further traces will be brought to light. Much rather, it can be proved that in the lands mentioned, Baptist churches existed for many decades and even centuries." Goebel, a German Protestant historian, perceived the inherent connection between the Waldenses and the early Anabaptists when he wrote this: "Wherever in Germany, before the Reformation, there were large bodies of Waldenses, there during the Reformation, large bodies of Anabaptists sprang up." The Anabaptists of the Reformation era were largely those known under other names before that time. I want to close our lectures now with some quotations, one from Luther, another from Calvin, and then two Anglicans concerning immersion. It is commonly thought, and it is held today, although the theory has been disproved for over 100 years in print, it is held by some of our Reformed Baptist brethren today that Baptists began to immerse in 1641. Before that time, they sprinkled. And immersion was discovered by them. It is rather in the facts of history that the common mode of baptism, even in the Church of Rome, was immersion until the 13th century. And that in Britain, the real transition from immersion in the Anglican Church to sprinkling came as the result of Calvin's influence and that of English Puritanism. But let me quote Martin Luther. "In the early days of the Protestant Reformation, Luther held to believers' baptism by immersion. Although I do not have the quotation before me, he saw a New Testament church and he said, 'God deliver me from a church of believers.'" You will find that in some of our histories that I have in my study. The Reformers held strongly to a state church because they needed the power of the military and of the civil magistrate. But I quote Luther. "Zwingli was the same. They began by immersing believers. Then they retreated into a state church concept." Let me quote Luther. "The term baptism is Greek and may be rendered dipping, as when we dip something in water so that it is covered all over. And although the custom is now abolished amongst many, for they do not dip children, but only pour on a little water, yet they ought to be wholly immersed and immediately withdrawn. For this is the etymology of the term seems to demand. And the Germans also call baptism taufe, from depth, which in their language they call tiefe, because it is fit that those who are baptized should be deeply immersed. And certainly, if you look at what baptism signifies, you will see the same is required, for it signifies this, that the old man and our sinful nature, which consists of flesh and blood, are totally immersed by divine grace, which we will point out more fully. The mode of baptism, therefore, necessarily corresponded with the significance of baptism, and it might set forth a certain and full sign of it. And now, John Calvin, in his Institutes of the Christian Religion, whether the person baptized is to be wholly immersed, and that once or thrice, or whether he only is to be sprinkled with water, is not of the least consequence. Churches should be at liberty to adopt either, according to the diversity of climates. Although it is evident that the term baptized means to immerse, and that this was the form used by the primitive church, Calvin's influence in England through English Puritanism marked the transition from immersion to sprinkling. To enforce this, I want to quote from the Anglican Archbishop Whately, who wrote, "Except upon extraordinary occasions, baptism was seldom, or perhaps never, administered for the first 4 centuries but by immersion or dipping. Nor is aspersion or sprinkling ordinarily used to this day. England was the last place where it was received, though it has never obtained so far as to be enjoined, dipping having been always prescribed by the rubric. The Church of England sprinkled, but before that it immersed infants, but it still immersed in obedience to the command." Dean Stanley, Anglican prelate, "For the first 13 centuries, the almost universal practice of baptism was that of which we read in the New Testament, and which is the very meaning of the word baptize. Those who were baptized were plunged, submerged, immersed into the water. That practice is still, as we have seen, continued in Eastern churches. In the Western Church, it still lingers amongst Roman Catholics in the solitary instance of the Cathedral of Milan." And I give an aside here and break into this quotation. That is because in Toulouse and Milan, they had great numbers of the Paterines, the ancient Anabaptists, who exerted their influence in that part of Italy. Now back to his quotation. "It lasted long into the Middle Ages. Even in the Church of England, it is still observed in theory. Elizabeth and Edward VI were both immersed. The rubric in the public baptism for infants enjoys that, unless for special cases, they are to be dipped, not sprinkled. But in practice, it gave way since the beginning of the 17th century." Just some footnotes and endnotes to our vindication of the Baptists. We are to earnestly contend for that primitive faith which was once for all delivered unto the saints. That includes the nature and character of the New Testament church. It includes the nature and character of scriptural baptism. If the mode of baptism is changed from immersion to anything else, if the subject of baptism are changed from believers to infants, then we have an altogether different significance and a doctrine to that which is clearly and manifestly taught in the Word of God. I trust this has been profitable, this vindication of the Baptists. This needs to be clearly and repeatedly brought home in this day, when even the very existence, nature, and character of a New Testament church has been abandoned by evangelical Christianity. Father,